Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. Now, while we might be a world of many nations, there's only one global environment, which is why we have international environmental law. Sydney University Emeritus Professor Dr. Ben Bohr has been here giving a series of talks in which he argues that the world needs to raise its game. He's with us now. Well, Ben, I suppose the first question has to be, how much international environmental law is there? Because it's not something we hear about a lot.
There are over 200 international conventions, multilateral and bilateral, that is to say, conventions that apply to the whole globe and then bilateral that apply between two countries.
What sort of things do these laws cover?
Well, let's just focus on some of the main ones. I think you can divide them into the brown issues and the green issues. The brown issues to do with pollution, both marine and terrestrial, and then the green issues have got to do with the conservation of biodiversity. Conventions such as climate change, of course, can span the two. So what we need to do is to actually look at the integration of the brown and the green issues, and that's one of the areas of research that I'm looking at the moment.
When I studied international environmental law at university briefly, and this is quite some time ago now, and it seemed that climate change wasn't even on the agenda, wasn't even on the curriculum. How much ground has had to be made up, and how much has the law had to change, adapt to deal with this new problem?
Well, firstly, climate change is not a new problem in the sense that anthropogenically we've been affecting the climate for the last 250 years.
I suppose it's been recognised as a problem, of course.
Correct. Yeah. So, in other words, when we think about modern climate change conceptions, we think about the anthropogenically caused climate change effects. It was really only in the 1980s that people started getting serious about it with the setting up of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 1988. But since that time, the last 17 or 18 years, we see an enormous amount of work having been done on the development of protocol to make sure that the actual climate change convention is adequately implemented. But with the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, we still haven't really got very far.
One of the big issues with any international law, it seems, is the teeth, getting the teeth into a mechanism, because it's unlikely that you will see a NATO-led force bombing, you know, Chinese coal mines, for example, you know, to try and solve the climate change issues in the same way that they might, you know, bomb the Middle East.
Not a good image.
and I'm not saying it's something I advise either, but the idea that it can be a toothless thing, can't it, international law?
Well, a lot of our students would say, you know, what's the use of international environmental law unless you can actually enforce it? There is a lot of work now being done on it. If you look at the Framework Convention on Climate Change, there are compliance mechanisms within it which do force countries to do national inventories and to wind down their greenhouse gas emissions. And over a period of time, that does happen.
And only if they're already inside it, though, correct? If you've got a true rogue state, there's nothing you can do about it.
Most of the countries of the world have signed up to Kyoto. The only, quote, rogue state that has not is the United States. Australia, of course, up to 2007 was also a, quote, rogue state, in your words.
Part of the axis of evil, yes.
I mean, the argument against this, particularly when you use words like forcing countries to do things, is that it tramples on national sovereignty, and that certainly seems to be the view in America, the prevailing political view there. How do you get around that?
Sovereignty can be looked at in a number of ways. Modern conceptions of sovereignty tend to turn the whole idea on its head so that when we're talking about the exercise of true sovereignty, it's a country reaching out to other countries and working with them rather than stopping at the border and saying, well, whatever you say as a world to us, we're going to ignore. But you still make a very good point in terms of the United States hanging on to its sovereignty desperately and not wanting to be, quote, dictated to by the rest of the world. But I wouldn't say this is necessarily the prevailing view in the United States. It's the view of a number of legislators, particularly in the Republican side, who do not want to sign up to new conventions and so on. They didn't want to sign up to the Convention on Biological Diversity when 190 other countries did so.
And it's a big, powerful bloc in the US, even if it doesn't represent majority opinion in the wider population. I think the relevant congressional committee, every single Republican on it was unwilling to acknowledge that climate change was a reality. That's a big mountain to get over, isn't it?
Yes. Well, these people are blindfolded. They tend to follow the party line, even though privately they might think differently.
One thing that we haven't seen that some people would like to see is environmental provisions in trade agreements. Do you think those will be important, and are they likely?
There are two ways of looking at this. The World Trade Organization and the does have, under Article 20, some provisions in relation to exceptions concerning environment and natural resources, and that has been taken into account in the various appeal body decisions. But if you can turn around the other way and say, do we need something to counteract the World Trade Organization, that's something that I think we really need to start looking at. On the other hand, I should also say that various international environmental conventions do have trade-related provisions. The most obvious one is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, which by its nature talks about trade, but not in the same way, necessarily, as the World Trade Organization might conceive of that. Still a very important set of provisions there.
So just briefly before we finish, what are the ideal solutions going to look like? What would you like to see happen?
One can, I think, fairly readily say that the world is going through at least a dual crisis in the environment. Climate change on the one hand, and the loss of biodiversity on the other. I argue that these matters are linked. And if, for instance, you start addressing climate change by what are called natural solutions, then we might start getting somewhere. What does natural solutions mean? What it means is using the natural environment to address ecosystem resilience by encouraging ecosystem resilience by a variety of methods. We're talking about ensuring that forests stay as they are and grow and expand rather than continue to be deforested. In the Amazon, there is an agreement between the eight Amazonian countries led by Brazil in order to actually lock up very vast areas of the Amazon, which are, of course, the lungs of the world. In the marine environment, there's now a lot of work being done on what they call marine forests to try and expand the ability of the marine environment, the capacity of the marine environment to absorb carbon more efficiently and more efficiently than terrestrial vegetation.
Well, I'm glad someone's doing the work, and best of luck with your work on this, Dr. Bohr. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Ben Bohr there. After the break, computers want me dead. Well, not me personally, but you get the idea.